You know, it has been so long since I was a little boy that sometimes I forget. I actually forget what it felt like. I used to relive being a little boy when my son was a little boy. When he would do something crazy and would then look up at me like I was crazy for being annoyed that he had done something crazy, I could see in his befuddled face my own befuddlement when my dad would be asking me, "Brian, why did you do that?" You don't remember much about the really early years when you were 6 or 7 because you're just too young, but some things get imprinted on your brain even then because of how ridiculous you felt at the moment you did it. I remember that my dad gave me this big assignment to take the water hose and rinse off the car. I don't remember why the car had become so muddy, but it was really muddy, and I was really excited that my dad asked me to take care of this particular critical business in the family. Me. I was going to go out there in the backyard with all the intensity of a NASA scientist figuring out how to stop an asteroid from colliding with the planet, get the hose, turn on the water, and rinse down that car. Not my older brother who got all the assignments, but me. And I'm waiting for my dad to come out and see me taking care of family business. And when he does, I've got the hose rinsing off the car tires and the bottom of the car doors. And then my dad looks at me and he looks back at the car and he says, trying to help me out, "Well, Brian, which way does water run?" And I proudly say, as the water fires out of that hose, "Down." And he nods, and I'm feeling good because he often tells me that I am so very smart. And then he looks back at the car and he says, "Well, why are you rinsing off the bottom of the car first?" And I look back and I see all the mud caked up at the top of the car and the clean bottom of the car. And I suddenly realize I'm cleaning the car upside down or backwards or whatever, and I just look at my dad like he's crazy. My right eyelid still twitches when I remember that, and for some reason I keep remembering that, and stuff like that just doesn't happen when you're little. For some reason, the cruel nature of life means it keeps happening. Like when I was in seminary, and it was before 9/11, and at the airport, they didn't have all the security they have now, and there weren't these jetways for airplanes, and I had been asked to represent my seminary at a conference at Duke University, and I was flying back home via the Philadelphia airport, and I was running late when I arrived at the Raleigh-Durham airport, and there were 2 planes parked on the tarmac, and when I asked which plane was my plane, and the guy at the entryway pointed and said, "That one," and I ran to the one that was that one, and I ended up getting on the wrong airplane. I mean, who gets on the wrong airplane? Sits down and buckles his seatbelt and watches them close the main cabin door and listens to the flight attendant say something silly like, "This plane is bound for Detroit. If your travel plans do not call for a visit to Detroit today, you'd better speak up now." Well, some days I close my eyes and I can still feel the eyes of the other passengers on me, the look on the flight attendants' faces, trying real hard and failing not to smile or just bust out laughing as I sheepishly haul my backpack down the aisle, going back up to the front of the airplane after they'd had to reopen the main cabin door, even as they told me they never reopened the main cabin door, to let me get off the wrong airplane so I can get on the right airplane. I wake up in the middle of the night every now and then, still on that wrong airplane. Crazy. When I think back on either of those two episodes, I cringe. And since I've lived for almost 60 years, you can bet that there are more than just 2 such episodes. I suspect we all have them. The only reason we can probably survive such moments of our own is that we realize everybody has such moments. And because we all have such moments, we extend just a little bit of grace when we see or hear of such moments happening to others. With what is that expression? "There but for the grace of God go I." Well, I'm thinking of James and John. Every now and then, this crazy moment that we read about in the scripture just now has to have rekindled like a highlight reel of foolishness in their minds. I can almost see them cringe every time the memory catapulted its way into their consciousness. You absolutely know the other disciples never let them forget it. I can see Peter and Andrew slipping up all innocent-like and then dropping the bomb. Hey, James, what's up, John? Remember that time you asked Jesus to sit at his right and left hand at the dinner table in heaven? Remember that? Wasn't that crazy? Years later, now that they better understand what Jesus' life and ministry were all about, now that he has died on the cross and been raised from the dead, now that he has in his post-resurrection experiences explained what his ministry was all about, now that they have had a chance to become servant leaders in that ministry themselves, now that they understand what it means to serve God by serving others, now that they understand what it means to sacrifice for others, what it means that Jesus sacrificed for them, now that they know better, how mortified they must have felt every time that episode of them asking Jesus for glory replayed itself or got replayed for them. You don't see how stupid a thing is while you're doing a stupid thing, or else you wouldn't do the stupid thing, right? You'd wish someone smarter were there to say, James, John, for God's sake, boys, what are you thinking? The signs were there for James and John, but they weren't paying attention. In his ministry, Jesus put others, lepers, tax collectors, sinners, women first so much that he risked angering the leaders of the people because of his efforts to help the people. But James and John don't see Jesus helping others. They see Jesus becoming important in the eyes of others. James and John see people treating this healer, this exerciser, this authoritative teacher as though he is special. In their eyes, he is a first century Palestinian rock star. And James and John want some of that. They want some of his glory to shine on them. And you know what? I'm wondering if Jesus is not partially to blame for James and John's this pitiful predicament. After all, it was Jesus who talked about coming back in glory at chapter 8, verse 38. Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of the Father. Jesus even appears in glorious premonition of that end time glory at chapter 9 on the Mount of Transfiguration, when it is clear that he is more glorious than either Moses or Elijah. Perhaps James and John can be forgiven for thinking that not only would there be status for Jesus, but that there ought to be some status for those who are following Jesus. After all they had to put up with, after all they had sacrificed, after all they were going to sacrifice, weren't they owed something? In the text just before our scripture text this morning, Jesus tells his disciples three times he's going to suffer and die, suffer and die, suffer and die, suffer and die. And just as importantly, he tells them that anyone who follows him must take up his cross and suffer with him. Since it is all but guaranteed they are going to suffer with him on earth, why shouldn't they get to be glorified with him in heaven? What is wrong with that? And if there's nothing wrong with that, what could possibly be wrong with asking for that? What could possibly be wrong with asking for what you deserve? My great-grandmother used to say, you don't ask, you don't get. All you adults in the sanctuary, think about how you dreamed. How you dreamed about what you wanted to do when you were all grown up. That is important thinking because you're going to be all grown up for a long time. You don't want to spend that long time doing something crazy. Well, the disciples were talking about eternal time. Eternal time is even longer than grown-up time. You certainly want to get eternal time right. Do you want to be in eternal time doing the wrong thing? You watch that popular television show, Downton Abbey? Well, I am the only one in my entire social circle who does not watch Downton Abbey. Every now and then I hear folk talking all of Twitter about Downton Abbey this and Downton Abbey that, and I'm feeling left out because people seem to get crazy when they start talking about the characters on Downton Abbey. And I think, well, maybe I ought to check out this show. Maybe I ought to binge watch some episodes and catch up. But by now, it's a matter of stubborn principle. I have become resolved to being Downton Abbey ignorant. So I know almost nothing about the narrative world of Downton Abbey. But even listening around the edges to people talking, I do know enough to know this. I know that there are gloriously rich people in Downton Abbey, and there are poor people in Downton Abbey who serve the gloriously rich people in Downton Abbey. If you were going to live in Downton Abbey for real, if their fictional world was going to be your reality world, would you want to be cast in the role of a poor serving servant? Is that your fantasy? When you're all Downton Abbey grown up, are you going to tell me that your dream is to be the servant? I remember growing up wanting to be like Dr. J on the basketball court. You grow up wanting to be Dr. J. None of my friends wanted to grow up and be the guy who took care of Dr. J's shoes or washed Dr. J's car or cooked Dr. J's food. We wanted to be Dr. J on the very least, at the very least, be the guy who is at the head of the line of Dr. J's entourage. Who wants to grow up serving people, even great people? You want to grow up being one of the great people who get served, don't you? But what is up with Jesus wanting disciples who do not want that? Jesus wants disciples who want to be servants, who want to give up their lives for other people. Can't you for just a moment identify with how confused James and John were? Now, Jesus seems to get it. He actually seems to understand. Too many readers of this text think Jesus gets angry with the disciples for yet again saying and doing something stupid. But Eugene Boring, explaining in his commentary on Mark's gospel, is right. Jesus doesn't get upset. Jesus just clarifies. Boring writes, Jesus' statement that the disciples do not know what they are asking is not a reproach. It's just a statement of fact. He tells them, look, I don't have the privilege of assigning seats in heaven. Only God can and will do that. See what he does not tell them. He does not tell them that they are wrong for asking. He does not say that they are bad men or ignorant men for asking. He just says, I can't give you what you're looking for. He does not even say it's wrong to look for it. He's like my great-grandmother, I think. If you don't ask, you don't get. So ask. They asked, he answered, and that was the end of it. It seems like Jesus is finished with this topic. It's over for him. It's done. We are the ones who think they are wrong for asking. Perhaps because we are like the other disciples. The other disciples are not angry that James and John make this request. They are angry that James and John think of it before they think of it. Again, Boring is helpful. He writes, in the honor-shame society of first century Mediterranean world, status was a legitimate goal and all were presumed to pursue it. The other disciples are resentful of those who had attempted to maneuver themselves into a favored place they all wanted. We know deep down that we all want that too. We who share in Jesus' struggle should have every right to wonder why we shouldn't share in a little bit of his glory. And that's when Jesus teaches. What he teaches is that the glory is actually in the service. The reward is actually in the struggle. The act of doing for others, living for others, sharing of yourself to make a difference in the lives of others is its own reward, is the only reward. They have been looking for glory that will come one day. Jesus is telling them that the glory is here this day, the day when you serve someone the way Jesus is serving them and others. Because they are so preoccupied about life in heaven, they are missing the point about life right here on earth. Somewhat ironically, while sitting there with Jesus, think about the way this is scripted out. While they are sitting there with Jesus, presumably at his right and his left hand, because the other disciples are not there with him, James and John asked to sit to his right and his left in his glory. Jesus directs them away from tomorrow and focuses them on today. Think about it. In his glorious ministry of serving God's people today, James and John were actually sitting where I suspect any one of us would cherish having the opportunity to sit. They were sitting already to Jesus' right and Jesus' left. Right then, right there, they had the glory, and they didn't even see it. The other disciples don't see it either. So when Jesus is back with all the disciples, I think he's trying to tell them what he'd been trying to tell James and John earlier. Look, stop thinking about heaven and where you're going to be sitting in heaven. Think about right now. Think about the people you engage with right now. Think about how the Gentiles work with you and how you would want to work with them when they take on a leadership role in society. They glorify themselves by belittling others. That's not how you glorify yourself. You glorify yourselves by becoming the kind of leader I am. Not a Gentile leader, but a servant leader. The glory is in the ministry. The glory is in what I am doing, what we are doing for others. Jesus is in his glory. They are sitting with him. They are standing beside him. More importantly, they are standing with him. They already have a glory they don't understand. Glory is bound up in service to others. And I'm talking about social, political, economic, as well as spiritual service to others. I know that many look at this text and they say, well, it looks to me like Jesus is talking about suffering for other people, that the glory comes from the suffering because he says he gives his life as a ransom for many. In other words, he suffered for others and that is glorious, so our glory will be in suffering for others too. The movie some time ago by Mel Gibson, The Passion of the Christ, emphasized this suffering glory by literally glorying in Jesus' suffering, showing none of Jesus' ministry, but magnifying every drop of blood associated with his trial and crucifixion. Well, the suffering happened as a result of service in Mark's gospel. The suffering is not the service. We don't serve God by suffering for God. Jesus' suffering occurred because people became angry and upset with how Jesus was serving God. I often use the contemporary example of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King's suffering was not his glory. Dr. King's assassination was not his glory. The glory was in the ministry, but people mad at the ministry made him suffer, ultimately killed him to stop him from prosecuting that ministry. A ministry that followed the guide of Jesus' ministry. Jesus came to give his life as a ransom for many, and because of that ransoming of many, the leaders of the people made him suffer, put him to death so as to stop him from ransoming too many. The clue is in the language. Ransom. An important word in the Greek, it's lutron. I know that a lot of Christians read that language and they think, well, Jesus was a suffering sacrifice for all our sins, and that is why he called himself a ransom for many. That's certainly how Mel Gibson's movie saw it. There is nothing, though, about social and political and economic service in this text. It is a text about a man getting glory, too many people think, because he suffered horribly, and thus we must suffer horribly as well. In a sermon several months ago, one of my trustees narrated an encounter with a group of little children at a children's sermon time, just like Rachel's. One of the children produced a bag of crackers and proceeded munching right there in the front of the church. After realizing that this child entertained no plan to share with the other children, she requested an explanation. At first, he just ignored her. And then sensing a teachable moment, she engaged him biblically. She said, remember Jesus and the little boy who shared his loaves and fishes? Lots of people were able to eat. Jesus came to teach us to share and be kind to others. The little boy's response was decisive. No, he didn't. He came for our salvation. He might as well have said he came to suffer for our salvation. That's how he served. Rightly, she wondered aloud with the congregation whether we Christian adults were not so different from that little boy. She expressed concern that we readily take to heart biblical verses about individual and spiritual salvation, but all too often exhibit squeamishness when preachers and teachers veer treacherously into conversation about social and political justice. After all, is not worship held in a sanctuary commonly defined as a place of refuge away from all that other stuff for just this reason? But Mark uses the word ransom, lutron. It is a social, economic, and political term. The ransom, a concept from the Old Testament, is usually a payment to redeem someone from slavery or debt. Listen to Boring in his commentary. As in English usage, a ransom is the payment made to obtain the release of slaves or hostages or prisoners of war. This word was often used in the Greek Old Testament in the sense of buying persons out of slavery or redeeming animals or property. That is, paying the necessary sum in exchange for them. It has the connotation of liberation. God ransomed the people of Israel from their enslavement in Egypt by the sending of Moses. Jesus ransoms his life by living it in a way that brings transformative challenge to Israel's cultic, legal, and ethnic traditions of separation and isolation. Remember his ministry. It is a ministry of touching lepers, of cavorting with tax collectors and sinners, of breaking the Sabbath, of breaking fasting tradition to feed and heal, of forgiving sins, of hanging around women, of outreach to Gentiles, and on and on and on. This is how his life does, and a disciple's life can serve God's liberating cause. This is service, and dare I say it, it is glorious service. So Jesus doesn't want to embarrass his disciples or reprimand disciples. Jesus wants to focus his disciples. Focus them away from heavenly glory to the earthly struggle here at hand. Their glory is in their service. Their liberating service that follows the lead of Jesus is liberating, ransoming of God's people. Our focus should not be on where we are sitting, but on where we are standing. We stand with any person or any people oppressed by the circumstances of living or by the unjust boundaries set up by the powerful to separate themselves and the possibilities of life from the powerless. Our focus should not be on the glory of heaven. Our focus should be on whatever glorious service we can provide for heaven's people here on earth. Had Jesus' focus been on heavenly glory, it would be right for us to ask, how do I get some heavenly glory? But since Jesus' focus was on ransoming earthly service, our question rightly put is, how do I ransom other people by my service? Where the gap between the wealthy and the poor is already a record divide and continues to widen monstrously day by day, how do I ransom the poor by my service? That's where the glory is. Where the issues that confront us daily are grievously difficult and our politicians are too gridlocked by ideology to seek solutions born of sincere compromise and justice for all, how do I ransom our political situation by my service? That's where the glory is. Where African-American males are endangered by the actions of unjust police officers of the law, how do I ransom African-American males by my service? That's where the glory is. Where so many police officers are endangered by the hatred and suspicion we hold toward each other, how do I ransom police officers by my service? That's where the glory is. Where young people are caught up in the hopelessness of inadequate public schools, how do I ransom a young person's dream of growing up to be anything she wants to be by my service? That's where the glory is. Wherever there is a person struggling or a people disintegrating, how do I ransom the vision of a new heaven and a new earth on the piece of dirt upon which I stand by my service? That is where the glory is. My answer for us is the same answer I think Jesus gave his disciples. Stop peering into the glory of heaven and focus on whatever ransoming service you can provide in the here and now. Because that is where the glory is. Amen.